The second narrating voice in the novel before we meet Dr. Forrest is that of Forrest's friend, the director of a psychiatric clinic called Dr. Stephen Hartford. Like his friend Gray Loughran, he's trying to help with the investigation of Forrest's disappearance, but his life is complicated by a close attachment he's developed to one of his patients, a young woman called Eloise Keaton. And that's complicated further by the fact that another of his inmates there, a disturbed man called David Tregaskis, has an obsession, it seems, with both Dr. Hartford and Miss Keaton. And that obsession comes to a head in this passage. I was planning my afternoon on the basis of being free to say goodbye to Eloise when I was told that David Tregaskis had requested, indeed demanded, an audience with me. I went to his room directly, ensuring Brian, our sturdiest nurse, was posted outside the door. There were dark circles under Tregaskis's eyes. He gazed sorely at me from seated. "She's leaving?" "Eloise?" I said. "Yes, she's checking out." "You decided that," he said. I shrugged. "She and I together. Her treatment is done. Didn't you know that? Since you and she have such a bond." That is the moment I do regret that needless barb. Yet it didn't seem to strike home. Tregaskis was in the depth of dolor. "I just don't hear her in my mind anymore," he muttered. "But I can see how wrong it all is, how wrong, wrong, wrong it is." "David, I'm sorry," I said. "We do need to look more seriously and honestly at this whole business of who you think is talking to you." He jabbed a finger at his sculpture, his clay woman on his desk. "Where do you think that came from, Stephen?" I was going to say I thought it had cracked out of his very own head when suddenly he grabbed my hand. "She's not human. Do you understand me, Stephen? Eloise, she's a vessel for a spirit. And the spirit is nothing but pure, brutal essence of self-seeking. Thinks of nothing but its own safety, its own advantage, how it can live and feed off others." At this point, I got up. He tried to bar me, began to shout. "I'm talking to you here, one sane man to another. You must not let her go." Then he was howling, jerking around, his hands in my face. Brian came barreling through the door. David kicked and windmilled his arms, but was soon neutralized, his face to the floor, Brian holding both arms. I didn't want to break out the haloperidol, but then nor was it lost on me that David has always feared and hated restraints. I stooped and told him calmly as I could. "This is not acceptable, David. I have to ask you to spend the rest of the afternoon in the seclusion room, unrestrained but on your own, until you're calm and I can trust you in that." He nodded assent between hard breaths. I went to the door. Brian helped him to his feet. "On your head, Stephen, I thought," he said. So I turned to him. "When what's going to happen happens, let it fall on your head, because you'll know I tried to warn you." Then he was silent, sat on the edge of his bed resignedly, looking into space with lackluster eyes. It was a sorry sight, not one that led me to anticipate in any way the violence that followed.